Tonight on Arena, we review Sally Rooney's new novel Intermezzo, and in TV, it's David Mitchell in Ludwig, season 2 of Monsters and season 3 of Industry. Hello and welcome to a very special Arena, in fact, this evening here on RTE Radio 1. A very warm welcome to the ISL community who join us tonight to watch our show on the RTE News Channel and on RTE.ie. I will start with the one sentence I've been practicing during the day. Happy ISL Awareness Week. Still finding week a little bit hard to do, but there you go. I hope you all get a great benefit from tonight's show being signed. Our ISL interpreter, Catherine White, who viewers will see on the small screen in the bottom right-hand corner, is also with us tonight. And thank you for joining us, Catherine. Great to have you as part of the show this evening as well. 51551, as always, is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE.arena. At RTE Arena. RTE.arena. RTE.ie/arena to watch us, and indeed you can also watch us on the RTE News Channel, and hope you can join us in that visual medium for this evening in particular. Tonight, TV reviews all about money and murder. The BBC HBO co-production Industry is back for a third season after first two, which saw the show go from cult following to global mainstream hit. This time around, the risk takers and pen pushers at Pierpoint Investment Bank are facing reputational damage after managing a complex stock market flotation with an unstable CEO. On Netflix, Ryan Murphy once again raids the salacious true crime annals with his latest series of Monsters, which depicts, be warned, in graphic detail, the notorious murders committed by wealthy Beverly Hills brothers Eric and Lyle Menendez, who shot their parents dead in 1989. And if that's too gritty for you, David Mitchell and Anna Maxwell Martin bring us Ludwig, the tale of a crossword maker who has to solve seemingly much trickier puzzles than the ones he sets. Jen Gannon, Chris Wasser with me in studio this evening, and we'll start with Industry. Starts this Tuesday of next week, that is, on BBC One, 10:40 in the evening. Several of the young stars of the series, of course, have gone on to notable Hollywood roles, not least Marissa Abella, who played Amy Winehouse recently. But notwithstanding the lure of the big screen for all of them, the series itself has been a critical hit on both sides of the Atlantic, with comparisons to Succession and Uncut Gems. Jen, I know you are a huge fan. This is season 3 of Industry. You've been there from the very beginning. What is it? All sorts of comparisons are made here. Succession is often mentioned when you hear Industry. But we're dealing with this place, Pierpoint, and these young, just, well, they're a little bit after graduation now, a few years on from graduation. And the dynamic in the workplace, essentially.
Basically, like the first season was about them as these graduates, young graduates, all entering at different backgrounds, different social backgrounds, entering into this very prestigious UK bank, investment bank, Pierpoint. And now we're at season 3 of this, where they have, you know, really dug down into who they are. Mm. So if like season 1 was about them trying to get on the ladder, more so, season 2 was about them developing in this world, in the financial world, and all that comes with that, the grey areas of making money, losing money. Then this season is about the risks that they're taking, or what they want to do, if they want to hang on in this world or if they want to get out of it completely, and about control and about who controls the money, who controls the power, who had those power dynamics.
But what struck me, and I think Chris is in a similar boat to me, as I watched today, I thought, if you haven't watched this up to now, there's no kind of holding your hand throughout episode 1. Although we are basically following Marissa Abella's character here, aren't we?
We are a bit at the beginning, yeah. So Pierpoint is, they're going to be celebrating their 150th anniversary, and everyone is in disarray. They seem to be moving up in the world, all the characters, but they're wrestling with their own demons. And with that, you have Yasmin, who is Marissa Abella's character. She's facing the scandal, the disappearance of her very sleazy father, who appears to have fallen off their yacht, which is named the Lady Yasmin, which is a very known reference, as we know, to Robert Maxwell, named and his yacht after his daughter Ghislaine Maxwell. And also, you know, they have a great quote about she's the saddest person, the saddest woman to ever have a yacht named after her. So she's becoming this tabloid fodder, and she's drawing this unwelcome spotlight into Pierpoint. And she's also fallen into this relationship with Lord Henry Mook, who's played by Game of Thrones' Kit Harington.
Yeah.
He's the new head of this eco-venture Lumi that Pierpoint have invested in. And he is bringing with him all that baggage too. And Rob, then we have this character, Rob, who is the working class kind of cipher within the show. He's always hanging on for dear life within Pierpoint. He's attempting to babysit Lord Mook with the disastrous launch of Lumi, and all eyes are on Pierpoint. And he's about to be fed to the wolves by them. And then meanwhile, you have someone like Harper Mahala's character, Harper
Stern.
Well,
don't go into too many other characters, because I think we just to get a
handle.
You might
be very confused. Yeah. Mind is boggled already.
To get a handle on it, we know that this Marissa Abella character, there are all sorts of references to the fact that it might be a Nepo appointment, nepotism.
She is the Nepo baby. She is the daughter of the publishing house that her father owns.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to what happens when she then goes along to do some client management at a handball alley, or a handball court, I suppose it would be, because it's a gentleman's club. They wouldn't have alleys, would they? Kit Harington plays Sir Henry Mook. Now, for years, my mother said Lord Mook.
There so he is, alive
Sir
and well.
Henry Mook is an ancestor, and he is the CEO of this energy company, Lumi. And we'll also hear Roger Barclay here, who's rather rakish and sleazy investor, it sounds, the character of Otto.
Yasmin, this is my uncle, Lord North.
Alexander, pleasure.
My godfather, Otto Mostyn, and this is Reynolds.
Where do I know you from?
I work at Pierpoint.
Pierpoint? My God, is that place still sold?
Actually, they've done a pretty first-rate job marketing Lumi.
It's closing up, isn't it?
£4.80, bought it.
Il mattino a loro in bocca.
The morning has gold in its mouth.
It's charming. I was at Balliol with your father.
Oh, my God, Charlie Anani. He used to double park his Jag on Radcliffe Square. He punched the air when he took a third. Dangerously handsome.
Dangerously stupid.
I admired him.
Sorry about my paper's coverage. I empower my editors, not my decision. But a lot of people are very angry with Mr. Anani. I don't acknowledge him to come out of hiding and stop letting his daughter take all punishment.
Yeah, that's the investor there at the end, is Roger Barclay as Otto. And we also heard Marissa Abella as Yasmin, and Sir Henry Mook, my favourite character name in a long time, played by Kit Harington in the midst of all of that. These are very posh people with a lot of money, Chris. Now, you came to this fresh.
Yeah, it's a little bit like going along to a party quite late in the night, and you get there and all of your friends have gone home and you have to make, you know, new friends, and you're coming into conversations too late. That is how I felt watching Industry for the first time. But it's okay, because a lot of the major players in this series, they're quite confused about what's going on half the time. And there are an awful lot of new characters, like Kit Harington. It was a surprise to me to learn that his character, you know, this Mook chap, he's new too, because there's no grand entrance for the new characters. It's a little bit like what Succession used to do. Mm. This famous actor playing this supporting character would just walk into the room, have a conversation with one of the main players, and then leave. And it's almost as though the creators of the show are saying to you, context and details will come later. You know, look, you have to lean into this show. We want you to chase it. It is a little bit intimidating, but it's actually quite thrilling. And I did pick it up as I went along. And I think the best way to approach it is, it treats the trading floor at Pierpoint a little bit like an arena, and it treats the characters then like gladiators. So you pick your favorite and you hope that nothing bad will happen to them. And I think my favorite, and this, I don't know what this says about me, but I was a big fan of Ken Leung's Eric, who was in a partner position this year. He's such a despicable character, but he was so interesting to watch, because he has this moral dilemma where, and Jim will know an awful lot more about this than I do, where he has to fire someone because he's in this partner position, and the other big boys at the table, they want him to show that he can be a boss. So he has to let someone go. And I found that aspect quite interesting, because as much as he wants to be the big man in the house, you know, it you can see that it's kind of tearing him apart too. So he'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, because it struck me as well, there's a touch of The Apprentice of this, except obviously this is a drama. This is not a real life show if The Apprentice is one of those. But this is a drama. But it has that kind of feel of it and that kind of dismissal intensity. Of people and intensity where you're up in front of the jury and if you get something wrong, you're gone.
It's high octane TV. And it's we're always thinking about when is a good time to watch Industry, because you want to watch it before you go to bed at night, or, you know, because it is that intensity of the trading floor and of the life. Basically, people treating money, it's life and death there. And, you know, something can sink and then you've lost millions. You've lost absolutely millions. And that's what happens, you know, in an earlier point to one of the characters, the main character, I suppose, is Harper Stern. And she goes up against Eric within those first two seasons. They have this very complicated relationship. It's almost like he's her mentor. She's the protege. But then also he realizes and sees how craven she is and how dangerous she is. And does he want to keep her on side and use her, or does he want to let her go and you know, eradicate her completely?
All right. Now, again, and I can hear that you're fully invested in those characters because you know them from seasons one and two. But can we go to it fresh? Unfortunately, we can't access the iPlayer.
I think there is a way if you have a Skybox.
Don't please
to go
tell say anything illegal.
Sorry, no, if you have the Skybox, this is legal. If you have Sky, I think there's a way to go through your box to access BBC One if they've reshowed it. So, other than that, I think you will be able to jump in, and it's the best time to jump in because they've learned from their mistakes. In season one All was right. outstanding. Season two had a little bit of meat on the bones. This is it, retooled, redone, and to like
Stars.
Right to the excess. I think every episode is jaw dropping. Everyone acts out of their skin. If I don't see Ken Leung getting an Emmy, I will be furious for his role as Eric. I think it's television at its best, at its most exhilarating, as its most exciting, and everybody should be watching it. We've already got a season four coming up, which could be the last season, but this is imperial.
So that's five.
Five out of five.
Yeah. Chris, now I know you, like me, you're coming to it a little bit new.
No, I'm going to go back for more. I'm going to go back to the very beginning. I think sharp wit, muscular performances help it over the line. I actually think it's nice to see Kit Harington, a performer who's been actually quite uncomfortable in front of the camera since Game of Thrones ended. It's nice to see him do some great acting for a change. So yeah, I'm all in. Yeah. I think four stars for now, but we'll see if five come down the line.
All right. See if five comes a little bit later on. It's clearly, I'm very excited about that, about Industry. Jen Gannon certainly will be watching the rest of it if she hasn't already done so. Let's move on to Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story, available right now on Netflix. Tells the true story of two wealthy brothers who murdered their parents in Beverly Hills in 1989. Notorious crime which captivated the media at the time. Series produced by Ryan Murphy. Glee, American Crime Story, American Horror Story. This is his follow-up to previous Monster series about the killer, the serial killer, Jeffrey Dahmer. You see, it was a story that captivated the media at the time. Salacious is the word that will keep getting thrown out here. This was a pretty nasty doing, obviously, back in 1989.
Grizzly. Just extraordinarily grim. You had two brothers, Lyle and Eric Menendez, who in 1989, the summer of 1989, they walked into their Beverly Hills mansion where they lived, two college kids, one of them 21, I think the other one was 18. Mm. And they walked into the den where their mother, Kitty, and their father, Jose, were watching television. And they raised two 12-gauge shotguns and murdered them in their home. And then they just left the house and came back later and reported the parents dead. It was a matter of months, something like 6 or 7 months before the police found out that it was the boys that did it, because one of them had actually gone to their therapist and had revealed to him. Much.
Well, let's have a listen to the scene where he does precisely that, goes to a therapist. It's Cooper Cooch here, is it, or Cooper Cock, I beg your pardon, playing the part of Eric, who's the kind of seemingly easier to lead brother of the two. And he can't deal with what he's done, hardly surprisingly. And he's talking, as he thinks, in confidence to his therapist, played by Dallas Roberts.
So we just started talking casually about it, like what it would be like to have this negative, controlling force gone from our lives. So we quickly made a plan. I wanted to do it soon, before we lost the nerve to go through with it. But Lyle really wanted to take the time, really plan it out. So we agreed we'd do it in about a week, probably on a Sunday.
Why on a Sunday?
Well, the maid was off on weekends.
Well, that's it? You watched a movie and you decided to kill your parents, Eric. Why?
Why what? Why did we do it?
Yes, Eric. Parricide is a very, very serious course of action to take.
What's parricide?
When you kill your parents.
Doesn't know the word, but he knows the action, that's for sure. That is Cooper Koch there as Eric Menendez in Monsters Season 2, and Dallas Roberts as his therapist within all of that. I was pausing over my delivery of those words, you know, captivated the media at the time, salacious, very vivid detail. I mean, the detail, we see the murder in Technicolor, huge detail. I wondered how necessary it was. But it's taking these, it's always the dilemma, isn't it? When you take a true life story like this, true life crime like this, and then you put it up for entertainment.
It's almost pornographic in its detail. And it's 9 episodes long as well. So be warned on that. And it's coming on, Ryan Murphy's, it's coming hot on the heels of him attempting to tell the story of Jeffrey Dahmer, which for all its assertion that it would focus on the victims, it felt lurid and very distasteful to me with barely any insight or analysis. And, you know, the Jeffrey Dahmer show was grinding and punishing, and I feel like he's not learned his lesson at all with this series about the Menendez brothers. It was the story, yes, that, you know, electrified America and dominated the newsstands about wealthy, good-looking kids who had every opportunity in life, but was there this darkness, you know, brewing beneath them? And, you know, Ryan Murphy does excel at bringing you into a time and a place. Yeah. He's very good at those details, pop culture details, everything from, you know, those Reebok runners they used to pump up to Milli Vanilli and Kenny G and Tim Burton's Batman. Everything feels really right and well done and well played. And he has this, you know, those historic markers that ground you in the late 80s and early 90s. But I do feel with the depiction of the brothers, you have someone like Lyle. He's this coked up sociopath.
Played by Nicholas Alexander Chavez.
He seems to be shouting a lot of his dialogue in his speedos. And I feel like what Ryan Murphy was trying to do is make his own Bret Easton Ellis, make his own, you know, twin version of American Psycho, which came out in 1991.
So we get the two brothers, and there is a focus on the two brothers, but the victims here, the father, played by Javier Bardem, and the mother, the father, Jose, who was this big businessman, and the mother played Kitty, played by Chloe Sevigny. We get a sense of who they were, and to be quite honest, anybody with parents like that would end up in a bit of a mess.
Yeah. So Javier Bardem is playing Jose, who is a top chief at RCA Records and also the CEO of what used to be Live Entertainment. So he was a very important man, which is why when the brothers, after they murdered them, I mentioned that kind of delay between the crime and them, you know, being arrested and charged and tried, because they were out there blaming it on the mafia. And it might have been believable that he, you know, Jose might have been connected to some very bad people who wanted to kill him. But Javier Bardem and Chloe Sevigny, who are playing the parents, they don't get that much to do, but they are quite effective in what we see of them. Javier Bardem doing that thing that he always does, which is so over the top. He's required here to play a very bad-tempered, nasty piece of work of a father, and he's doing that very well. But the focus is on the brothers, and the actors playing them, Koch and Chavez, they do commit themselves entirely to the role, the same way that Evan Peters did when he was playing Jeffrey Dahmer. Sometimes you're thinking to yourself, these are wonderful performances, but I'm a little bit unsure about what Ryan Murphy and his showrunner pal Ian Brennan are trying to say here, because one minute they're trying to show us that, oh, look at these boys, they were being abused and tortured and they had such a terrible, frightening upbringing. But then it's like, no, look at them, they're horrible. They did this for the money. They're constantly moving the goalposts. And Ryan Murphy has actually been asked about this in interviews, what was the intention here? And he's all about, you know, saying that, you know, there was a story to tell and he wanted to kind of, you know, explore the areas that might not have been in the news at the time. But I don't really know what the purpose is here. And I think that the scene that sums up what I think Ryan Murphy and Brennan we're trying to do with this show is when we get to the murder. It's up close, it's gratuitous, it's disgusting, it's so nasty and unnecessary. And I think you can do a murder like that very tastefully, and you could do it artfully where we didn't have to see it.
All we had to hear is the shot.
Exactly. We could have just listened to it.
Yeah. We can work out what happened after ourselves.
And I think that one scene just sums up what this show wants to do. It wants to
more
shock
is
you.
More.
It wants to
but
get conversation.
It also wants to have its cake and eat it too, because it wants you to it presents these brothers, which we don't know. This is just, you know, rumor. Like, there's this slant about hyper focusing on the brothers and their bodies that feel feels kind of seedy and leads to this like topless kissing where it's like there was an incestuous relationship. And then it has, you know, this astonishing episode five about abuse that really trains the camera on Eric and his confession about the abuse from their father. But then it pulls the rug from under you after those episodes and says, well, maybe we're all being manipulated.
Yeah, so I felt very... I wonder what you're being told. Okay, we should mention Dallas Roberts as the therapist. That's a very important character and it does bring us into a different areas as well, which are quite interesting. Stars, though, from you on this one, Jen. Just stars, not a big long comment.
I just felt that, you know, it was disturbing and I felt like manipulated and misdirected by the show from episode six onwards. So I think, I mean, it's completely sensational and lurid and I could only give it 2.5 then for that.
And Chris?
Just disorganised, immoral, bottom of the barrel. Great performances and it looks great at times, but I don't need the show in my life. 2 out of 5.
2 out of 5. Let's move on then finally to Ludwig. Starts on BBC One this evening, 9 p.m. Much more cosy type of drama and crime than the one we've just been talking about. It stars David Mitchell and Anna Maxwell. David Mitchell as a twin who's, well, let us, his brother goes missing. But here he's very close to the top. He gets a phone call from his sister-in-law and old friend, Anna Maxwell, asking him something.
8928.
Hello, John.
Lucy.
Birthday or an anniversary. I need a favour. A big one.
How big?
Pretty big. It's going to involve you having to leave the house and get into the taxi that I've booked for you.
Taxi? There's a taxi outside my house. Lucy, why is there a taxi outside my house?
Because I've known you since we were 6 years old.
5 and 4 months.
Meaning, I know all too well that the only way I'm going to get you to travel the 140 plus miles to Cambridge is if I book you one.
And then very annoyingly refuse to tell you why on the phone.
What the? That's ridiculous. Lucy, I can't just...
I'll match whatever you're making for dinner, like for like. Given that it's Sunday, I am assuming pasta.
Carbonara.
So he has exactly the same thing in every day. He loves crossword clues and he's called up 100 whatever miles it is to Cambridge to meet, to talk to his sister-in-law. I mean, we get a sense from that. There's kind of, it's funny, it's a bit of black comedy in there. And it's very easy watching.
So easy to watch. And I'm so glad to see David Mitchell escaping panel shows for once, like going back to his TV roots. And it just shows how good he is when you put him in these, you know, in a dramedy like this. And it's a very pleasing show in the way that it's like very analog, almost retro, because, you know, his character wants to do things from scratch. It's all about the pens. It's all about the fax machines.
Solving the clues,
But like, it's not about Google. He has this brick of a phone, like an old Nokia, and he still uses his old home phone as well. And it kind of puts you in the mindset of, it feels like one of these old kind of mystery of the week shows. And part of that is the mystery of the week, because he's playing his brother. He's trying to pretend he is his brother, but he seems to can't help himself but get involved in the crimes that his brother is trying to solve. And
he's going to use his crossword
puzzle pass to do that.
His crossword
making
and setting the skills to solve this. So it's a classic kind of, you'll be drinking tea or even Horlicks.
Late
at night watching this, I would have thought.
It would have worked very nicely for a Christmas release. I think they should have held on to it. And when you get to that part of the week, because there is a murder mystery of the week to sit alongside the bigger mystery of the missing twin. And I think whenever David Mitchell's character, John, the crossword setter, whenever it comes time for him to do the big reveal and say, this is how I got the murder, you're sitting there to yourself, I don't know what he's talking about, but it's fun to watch.
It's a bit like the Columbo at the end when he explained everything. There's a touch of that.
And I think whoever thought that we needed a David Mitchell-esque character played by the actual David Mitchell solving murders as part of, you know, primetime television, they deserve a raise. So I think it works.
Stars.
I think there's a little bit of Only Murders in there, Death in Paradise, Father Brown. If you stick with it long enough, you find that it actually has its own ideas, its own identity and its own purpose, and Mitchell is perfect for this. So it's off to a good start. 3.5 out of 5.
3.5. Jen?
It's Sherlock doing Sudoku, and what's wrong with that? It's lovely. What a nice show to end on, I think. And I think the performance is really elevated, and David Mitchell is
and
great.
And Anna Maxwell
is
great as well.
Brilliant. So I give it a sturdy 3.
A sturdy 3. That's Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. Season 3 of Industry is is on BBC One from October the 1st at 10:40 in the evening. All episodes of Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story, available on Netflix right now. And Ludwig starts this very evening. Get the Horlicks out. BBC One, 9 p.m. Chris Wasser. I was going to call you Chris Menendez. Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon are reviewers this evening. And welcome back to tonight's Arena. Particular welcome to the ISL community who are with us this evening, watching us hopefully on the RTE News Channel and indeed on rte.ie/arena. As part of ISL Awareness Week, we have ISL interpreter Catherine White, who viewers will see on a small screen in the bottom right hand corner, signing everything that we are saying this evening here on the programme. There is no bigger publishing event this year. That's the word in the queues for bookshops all around Ireland and beyond, as fans of Sally Rooney, the author of Conversations with Friends, Normal People and Beautiful World, Where Are You?, wait to get their hands on her new novel, which is called Intermezzo. Once the reader finally purchases and breaks open the blue and white cover, adorned with images of a grieving man, a whippet and a chess piece, will they find classic Rooney? Well, maybe or maybe not. Intermezzo brings us the story of brothers, Peter and Ivan, who have just lost their dad. Both are grieving, but Peter, the successful human rights lawyer, and Ivan, the chess champion, cannot see eye to eye on grief or on most things in life, in fact. Brotherly conflict is at the centre of Intermezzo, but it's a book also populated with complex female characters. Sylvia, the intellectual struggling with physical pain, Margaret, the separated arts administrator, and Naomi, the unconventional, free-spirited squat dweller. Alex Clark and Sunita Apyakarang have been reading Intermezzo for us. They're with me in studio this evening. Alex is joining us online, in fact, and Sunita is with us here in studio. Alex, I mentioned the hype around the book at the very beginning. Now, we don't want to just talk about the hype, but I mean, this is something akin to Harry Potter type mania around the publication of this book.
Well, with all sorts of the kind of book selling hoopla and queues outside shops and midnight openings that, as you say, that Harry Potter entailed. I mean, it's interesting, particularly because Rooney herself has spoken so often about how she doesn't want to give credence to that kind of fuss and that kind of sort of cavalcade of attention. She wrote about it a lot in her last novel, Beautiful World, Where Are You? So it's interesting to see it. It's very hard, I think, for a critic and indeed a reader to separate themselves from all that chatter, but that is the job in hand.
And one of the big arguments sticking with you for the moment, Alex, is this: whether this is a departure for Sally Rooney or not. Conversations with Friends, Normal People, Beautiful World, Where Are You? You know, female protagonists essentially following important female characters for large parts of those novels. We are with two brothers here, Ivan and Peter.
Yes, that's right. And it's also, you know, there are big stylistic differences too. This is a very, very much more interior novel. This happens mostly in people's heads rather than through the things that they say, although there is dialogue. And the two brothers are presented very, very differently. Mm. And in a way, it's a sort of clash, not just between them as personalities, but as thought systems, belief systems of how they believe a human should operate in the world. So it is a departure, although I would argue that there are lots of similarities between this book and her previous work.
Yeah, there are some classic Sally Rooney moments within all of these, within this book, as there are in the previous books, obviously, as well. Sunita, while the focus may be on the two brothers here, it would be very remiss of us not to mention incredibly well-rounded and strong female characters involved with both men, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. We get introduced to three other women. Peter, the older brother, soulmate essentially, and kind of childhood sweetheart, Sylvia, with whom he had a flame and then it tragically ended, is kind of held as a character that kind of poses a mirror to him in terms of, you know, he's this high-flying lawyer with very kind of absolutist, very kind of solid ideas of how the world works and how he operates within it. And they ideate between each other. That's kind of the essence of the relationship and the beauty of it, and some of the pain of it as well. Now, I suppose she's probably the lesser explored character in the book, probably by comparison to Margaret, who takes more center stage and is given a kind of a deeper voice and introspection throughout the book. And Margaret is Ivan, the younger brother, the chess player's love interest, who's 36 years old, lives in Leitrim and is an art curator. So a bit of a salacious kind of story there in terms of the dynamic of an older woman taking on a younger lover, and she was married and she's not fully divorced, and the kind of the moralistic quandaries of that, the ethics of whether, you know, it's okay to love whenever there's this big gap. And I suppose in both of their cases, they're very much, you know, in Margaret's case, she's a woman that was bound by duty to stick with a husband that was an alcoholic, and that the quality of their marriage and life deteriorated massively until they separated. And living in a small town like Leitrim, fictionally, I imagine that the questions around that are around the ethics of, like, is it right to have one, a romantic affair of this kind of nature? But two, there's questions around, like, the kind of question of, like, what is it to live and what is it to love, and what permissions can you give yourself, basically. To
And that age gap is also something, Alex, that is explored within the relationship between the two brothers as well.
The older brother, and a lot of the time you think that they are, you get the sense that they are acting out a lot of their painful relationship with one another via their romantic relationships. They have some really stand-up confrontations. They spend an awful lot of the book not speaking or being in touch at all, and they clearly have a sort of love that borders on dislike and sometimes hatred, or at least they think it's hatred. And in a way, it puzzled me, because I thought the issue of their grief for their father, which reveals itself, I would argue, as really perhaps the book's main theme. Rooney has evidently decided to present it as a novel of primarily erotic, sexual and romantic desire.
Which again is something that we have seen in previous novels.
Absolutely. But it's as if people are using this, they're using the idea of what is going to happen in their love life as a way to work out how they communicate in the world and with people who are not their lovers.
And one thing that really struck me, Sunita, and I think you picked up on this as well, I'm sure you did too, Alex, but Sunita, the difference in register between when Peter is kind of leading the story and when Ivan is leading the story, and later on when we get Margaret is certainly given the reins for large sections.
Yeah.
But the difference between the stylistic difference between Peter's voice and Ivan's voice is quite marked.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's probably one of the things that stood out to me in terms of what differentiates this book to Sally Rooney's prior books, how she captures the personality of Peter, the sci-flying lawyer again, who is self-medicating on prescription drugs and also drinks quite a lot. And when he's in that chaotic mode of kind of just operating at 90, the pace of his thoughts and the way that he interacts is just like nearly like a kind of improv jazz style description of his surroundings and of his pace of thought and such. And then when he's with Sylvia, for instance, who's kind of like his salve, a person that he feels safe with, it kind of slows down a lot more, and you can kind of see this tension of how he's probably, you know, mentally unwell and not really dealing with this well, and leans into his professional accolades and all of these things as a coping mechanism. By contrast, then you have Ivan, his younger brother, the chess player, which it's implied that he's probably neurodivergent or has autism of some
sort.
But
it's never clear.
Not explicitly
said. Certainly Peter believes it.
Right, exactly. There's a lot of accusation. Yeah. And I guess like the tension there as well is in that accusation of Peter that he's autistic, there is an implication that he doesn't have the capacity to have substance or kind of pick up on nuance. And yet I actually found a lot of Ivan's introspective thoughts as being, while structured very boxy and measured and very considered and methodical, like nearly having a deeper kind of poignancy in terms of the things that he was suggesting, like using mathematical equations nearly
to work things out.
You know, so there was something in that was just different. And I loved that Sally brought like a deep humanity and sensitivity to Ivan's role and gave him so much more, just depth in a 23-year-old young
fella. Because I've certainly felt sections with the Ivan character in particular that I found myself, you're all right, stop worrying about yourself. You're grand, you're a lovely
but
man.
But that's also so quintessential of being a 23-year-old.
Yeah,
like
absolutely,
he explains things so excellently, meticulously, but then always with this kind of question at the end of, if you get me, and that, you know, that kind of implies back to the tension of maybe that self disbelief because of the relationship. Yeah,
not quite sure of himself just quite yet. But show me the 23-year-old that was or is. Generally, it comes a little bit later. Yeah. And maybe not at all. Chess, he's a chess player, Alex. Ivan is a chess player. Is there a big motif going on there? Obviously, the Queen's Gambit brought chess into a whole, you know, kind of popular culture way, particularly the Netflix series. And it does get a mention along here. But how is chess used to explore ideas in the novel?
Well, there is a bit of actual chess exposition. You know, there are little bits of games described. And I have to say, those are bits I thought, I'm not going to understand this, so I'm not going to try, and I'll try to think what Sally Rooney wants to be doing with them. I mean, I think it explains that it is that one of the most interesting things for me, and also puzzling things about it, is that it's a very heavily schematic book. I mean, characters do move around to an extent like pieces on a board. And we move towards a kind of resolution. We move towards something that in some ways, some readers, including me some of the time, might find overly sentimentalized. And I wondered if that was Rooney kind of saying, you know, look, we have to end the game at some point.
Yeah.
You know, this story has to come to an end. I'm going to end it with pieces on the board having reached certain positions, even if I don't entirely believe it.
And there's quite definitely, particularly in the voice of Peter, I think, a nod towards Joyce and the moving around the city that Joyce has, obviously.
Yes,
most
and also,
in Ulysses.
Also in the language. I mean, some of the you know, exactly that kind of jazz free flow as you mentioned, but, you know, that just the way the sentences are turned upside down, you know, verbs start the sentence, you know, adjectives start the sentence. It's sometimes very jarring and very odd. And as we've said, you know, Ivan speaks in these, or thinks and speaks in these very, very meticulously constructed ways.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention just before we get your final judgment on it, conversation with his friends and normal people, I suppose, more so than anything, such a huge television hit. And obviously the dialogue within Sally Rooney's novels always notably well handled. How is she handling it here, Sunita?
I would say the dialogues were probably where she shone the most. I think that the thing that she captured really well for me, I suppose, is kind of the, like, taking Peter and Sylvia's relationship. So age-old friends had been going out. Are kind of like intellectual counterparts as well as close friends, and, you know, capturing this shorthand that kind of happens with familiarity and someone that you just know like the back of your hand, right? So there's lots of implied looks as well as dialogue happening. Like, just capturing that warmth is so I suppose just synonymous with Sally Rooney's style. Like, she really kind of knows how to, like, get to the essence of the desire and the familiarity and the warmth of a close relationship. By contrast, then there's like these hugely climatic moments between herself and Ivan. So they meet halfway through the book, part two. They have a forced lunch in which they're trying to kind of rekindle their relationship because they've not really been attuned to each other for a couple of years. They're trying to get to know each other. And again, you can kind of get the existential threat that is here, right? They've lost their father. They're not particularly close to their mother. They're reiterating what that family unit relationship looks like, and there's this want to be close, but they're so adjacent to one another that it immediately turns into this spark fire argument around how they conduct their lives.
Overall, Alex, did it work for you as a novel, Sally Rooney's Intermezzo?
I absolutely came away with more questions than I had answers. I don't think that that's a bad thing in a novel, but I think there were some very interesting and faintly disturbing silences in it, as well as so much being said.
And the silences were strong or not?
Sometimes they were, sometimes they weren't. I mean, I kind of felt that we were left with a very odd sense of the character whose mind is not gone into, Naomi's.
Yes, who's a young woman with whom, I don't know if you call it an affair, but Peter certainly in a relationship with her, it's very unclear as to what the nature of the power balance is there.
Well, he is paying her a lot of the time to have sex with him. The fact that she seems at many points entirely delighted with this does not take away from that power dynamic. And I thought, in a sense, that was underexplored. And I think, in a way, it became an overcomplicated way of telling what essentially was quite a simple story. But that's not to take away from the incredible power that she has to write about claustrophobia in physical spaces, in sexual and love dynamics, and in people's own minds.
Yeah. And a final few sentences from you on it, Tanita.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll say this is personally one of the more readable Sally Rooney books. I just felt like the structure, the pacing of it, the plot development was punchier for me. I really believed the characters. I felt like it kind of sits in the canon of nearly Philadelphia, Here I Come, like that kind of tension between two people that love each other but just totally misunderstand each other and are unable to articulate in any meaningful way that they love each other. So yeah, I really thoroughly enjoyed it.
All right. Intermezzo by Sally Rooney is the book we've been speaking about, published by Faber, Alex Clark and Sunita Appiah-Kerang. Thank you for your review this evening. Now, Sunday afternoon at the National Concert Hall, the National Symphony Orchestra presents Our Precious Planet, Celebrating Nature. Family concert of music and storytelling features live animation by award-winning illustrator and animator Greg Warpon that will be projected alongside thrilling music performed live by the full forces of the National Symphony Orchestra. Gavin Maloney conducts. The afternoon will be narrated by Jesse Grimes, the National Concert Hall's first learning and participation artist in residence. Delighted that Jesse and Greg War are both with me in studio this evening. And just a reminder for those watching us on the RTÉ News channel that Catherine White is our ISL interpreter, as she has been since 7 o'clock this evening. This, Gregoire, I have to say, I was talking to you about it. I watched a YouTube version of the BBC Symphony Orchestra playing these various contemporary pieces and modern pieces and your live illustrations going on as they played. Explain what you were doing, because it's at the essence of, I think, what Jesse had in mind when choosing this piece.
Bonjour. So I am Greg Warpon. I am an illustrator and I love classical music. And what I do is not just illustrating the music. I'm trying to help the audience listening to the music. I don't want to fight against the music. I want to... I'm like a dancer, you know, it's like a choreography, but if you can't see me in the radio, but I can't dance.
Can see you if they're watching on the news channel, by the way. I might put you up dancing in a minute now if you don't behave.
I could. So this is, my drawings help the people to go with the music and to be synchronized with it. It's like enhancing the music.
Yes.
Why am I saying that? It's because I don't want to... The classical music audience, sometimes they don't like to have videos with them. But I think what I do is just helping the audience to watch it.
Yeah,
I mix drawings and animations.
Yes.
This is what I do.
And we actually see live animations happening in time to the music, which is quite extraordinary. Jesse, this piece you really wanted, some of the music within it is quite challenging music if you were just to listen to it by itself. But I think when Gregoire's illustrations and animations are happening in the background, suddenly I'm watching that and the music is just seeping into me without me having to think about it too much.
Yeah, and I think that's with any of this sort of, I always go air quotes, classical music.
Yeah.
People talk about, oh, this is difficult or this is new or this is hard, but this is also a family concert and we're aiming this to blow the minds of kids, and kids are a blank canvas. They will listen to Mozart or they'll listen to Danny Howard or Anna Meredith with the same open mind. So I don't believe that any of the young people who will come on Sunday will say, oh, that was terribly contemporary. They'll just go, whoa, that was cool.
Yeah.
And this music is so brilliantly chosen and it matches with the art that Gregoire is creating live in front of us that I think it will really, I imagine there's going to be a lot of slack-jawed kids and wide eyes and just, and well, that's the magic.
Yeah, the moment that I was caught from the moment the Big Bang happens, which is about 5 or 6 minutes in. So we get a narration that's telling us we're talking about the planet, we're talking about how we need to look after our precious planet. That's basically what we're being told here. But then we get this piece of Messiaen music, and about 5 or 6 minutes in, the whole thing explodes with the orchestra going wild, and you give us not the big bang, but kind of lots of kind of interpretive explosions on the screen.
Yeah, it's very the music in the first moments are very peaceful, and it's we are in a dream, in the dream of there is nothing and some stars, and yes, the bang is massive, is surprising, and so I made constellations exploding all around, and it looks really great. But if you knew how I did that, you would be laughing, because I was in my garden with my niece. We had a white table, we were spreading oil and paint and salt, and you know, the thing for the window, to clean the window.
Yeah, window lean, we call it. Yeah,
it creates wonderful nebulas. So it, and you will see that on the screen. It's really effective.
It's very effective. So we get the big bang, we get the birth of the universe, if you like, and the stars. We get plants and things starting to grow. Now then we go into the sea world, and let's have a listen to a piece of the music that brings us into the sea. So there's, that's just a little section from Argentum, which is getting its Irish premiere, actually. This, it is getting its Irish premiere as part of this performance. Danny Howard is the contemporary composer who has made this piece. And I was saying, Jesse, as we were listening to that, Gregoire's illustrations for this, I was in Under the Sea, I was in the world of Nemo, lovely bright coloured fish, and the underwater life.
Yeah, they're beautiful, and they really, I think Danny Howard's composition is really gorgeous and kind of rapturous and beautiful, and it just, it's really, really evocative, and the illustrations really match. And we were just saying, as that music was playing, how awesome it is to have two living female composers as well, Danny Howard, and the next piece that happens, which I think at one point, Gregoire, you said you're very proud of the illustration during Anna Meredith's Nautilus, which is this awesome sort of grungy rock kind of sound, with this whole symphony orchestra thumping, and we have the beginning of human destruction of the planet.
Yeah, because it does become, I mean, it goes into dark places, certainly in that respect, Gregoire. You do show us the potential for the planet to literally crumble, fall apart, and go on fire.
Well, the first half of the concert is really the beautiful nature and how to say that, it's amazing and
verdant
colors, and everything is peaceful and well organized. But then man comes, and it's straight lines, like scratches on the earth, etc. Can I just say something about the Meredith's Nautilus? This music is the most massive music you will ever have the chance to hear. It's like Le Ravel Bolero, but with a techno parade rhythm.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of Nautilus. Yes, the brass section will enjoy that particular piece of music. Yes. Nautilus, Meredith, what is her first? Anna Meredith. And again, that's getting his Irish premiere as part of this, as is Panic from Dr. Atomic Symphony by Adams. There are other, I suppose, possibly better known pieces within this as well. I do want to play another one of them. But before we do that, actually illustrating live with the music, how nerve-wracking is that? Because, you know, some of the lovely little fine details, flowers that you're drawing and these little leaves on the edge of them, how do you do that in sync with music?
Well, it's not easy because sometimes I just have 10 seconds to draw a bird and 10 seconds is very short, but I know that after these 10 seconds, the orchestra goes bang, so I don't have the time. So this is why I've prepared many things before, animations and landscapes, and I just add some details. But my technique is, the trick is when I draw a bird, then I press a button and the bird I just drawn flies away. So it's very funny for the children and helpful that when the music is calm, I can draw. I have all my time. When the music is quick and speed, I can't compete, so I need animation for that.
Well, put on your headphones because I want both of you to listen to this piece, and I'm going to ask you to talk about how you went about illustrating this. This is from the final piece, because hope does come back at the end, basically through the eyes of the children. It's the children that we see, in inverted commas, saving the planet here in some ways. And it's a Poulenc piece. And there's a little waltz in the middle of it. Just take it in underneath us. Jimmy, take it in underneath us quietly. You send the bird, Gregoire, waltzing across the screen while this is happening.
This moment is heartbreaking for me because it's very typical Poulenc.
Yeah.
It can be very joyful and light and festive, and sometimes there is a break and we cried. It's so beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
It's like you're in love in a park in Paris and there are sunflakes on the ground. This is typical Poulenc. So this is why it gives hope in the end.
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah. So French.
There we go. I've got to have to get out. You know, you can be in love in a park in Dublin as well, but it does sound much better, a park in Paris. It's very exciting, isn't it? I think it's probably a better place to fall in love, potentially. This is obviously part of your residency in the whole learning area within the National Concert Hall. Is that coming to an end, or is there more to come,
Jesse?
Just
kicking off. This is the first one of the whole season. So next in October on the 19th, we're taking apart Beethoven 5. They set me up with a challenge to start off with. So we're doing a symphony shorts.
And given that we're speaking, the ISL community is listening, watching and listening to us this evening. I mean, the Beethoven story is very interesting and something that I think has unfortunately started to affect you.
Struck a chord. Yeah, I'm going deaf. I'm about 70% deaf in my right ear. Hearing aid wear, if anyone's watching on the video. Reading Beethoven's letters and reading the way he was losing his hearing is quite similar to what I was going through and I'm going through. Currently at a bit of a plateau, so maybe it mightn't go any further. It's a condition, but it's very personal to present this, and it's a really interesting challenge to present this story of kind of overcoming adversity that Beethoven, the story of Beethoven in essence in writing music when you're completely deaf, because of course deaf people can love music as well, and that's really important to say that it's
absolutely because the vet will be on Evelyn Glennie, the great percussionist, who played. Using the vibration was how she knew what she was doing on how she knows what she's doing on the instruments, and so that's the Beethoven shorts. That's a little bit further down the line, but Our Precious Planet, which Gregoire will be illustrating live, I so wish I could be there, 2 o'clock this Sunday at the National Concert Hall, nch.ie. Gregoire Pont and Jesse Grimes, thank you so much for being with us this evening. And Catherine was signing, I believe, some of the music. I don't know how she managed to do that. Maybe she was doing a little waltz as we did it. what a wonderful addition to our programme that was this evening, our ISL interpreter, Catherine White. Thank you so much, Catherine, for what you gave to us this evening and what you added to the programme. The RTE Access Officer, Tracy Carr, the FLR team, Darren Keogh and Amy O'Reilly, all making it possible for our ISL community to watch and be part of this evening's programme. The research this evening was by Leah Murphy. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. With you tomorrow night, once again, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.